Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with outrage expressed by Secretary of State Kerry at the blatant attempt to sabotage nuclear negotiations with Iran, and examine the rise of foreign policy neophytes and ignoramuses, such as the author of the letter signed by 47 Republican Senators Tom Cotton, and the Republican frontrunner for president, Scott Walker, who claims that Ronald Reagan's firing of a bunch of air traffic controllers was, quote, the most consequential foreign policy decision of his lifetime. Michael Cohen, a former chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative at the UN and a columnist at the Boston Globe, joins us to talk about his article at Foreign Policy, State of the Union Buster, and to discuss growing anti-intellectualism in Republican leadership ranks that began with John McCain's choice of Sarah Palin as a presidential running mate. Then we will speak with Andrew Coben, the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, about his new book, Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. We'll discuss the increasing reliance on targeted assassination by the White House, the Pentagon, and the CIA, and the little-known history of the burgeoning drone program that is led by a shadowy, eccentric figure, as well as the deficiencies and flaws in these high-tech weapons that are making contractors like Northrop Grumman rich with their $300 million Global Hawk drone that Pentagon insiders call a piece of junk. Then finally, we'll look into the decision by the ATF to abandon an effort to ban so-called green-tip bullets that can pierce police protective vests, particularly when fired from handguns that now fire this type of assault rifle ammunition. Daniel Webster, a professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, where he serves as the director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research, joins us to discuss why the White House caved in the face of an NRA campaign that enlisted 291 members of Congress who claim that banning cop killer bullets is an assault on the Second Amendment. And before we begin, I'd like to invite you to the UCLA Hammer Forum. I'm moderating Terror in the Name of Islam on Thursday, March the 19th at 7:30 p.m. We'll have former MI6 official Richard Barrett and a former jihadi, Mubin Sheikh, providing insight into why young Muslims in the diaspora join jihadist movements. Mubin Sheikh joined al-Qaeda, traveled to Syria for religious education, but then relinquished his violent interpretations of Islam and volunteered with the Canadian Security Intelligence Service to fight terrorism. Again, Thursday, March the 19th at 7:30 p.m., Terror in the Name of Islam, free and open to the public at the UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood. Join me. And joining us now is Michael Cohen, a fellow at the Century Foundation and a columnist at the Boston Globe, where he writes a regular feature on politics and national security. Previously, he served in the U.S. Department of State as chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations, and is the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. And his latest article at Foreign Policy is State of the Union Buster. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Cohen.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And is there something going on here in terms of the rise of these foreign policy neophytes and ignoramuses in the Republican Party, such as the author of the letter signed by 47 Republican Senators Tom Cotton, and of course the Republican frontrunner for President Scott Walker, who in your article on Foreign Policy point out claims that Ronald Reagan's firing of a bunch of air traffic controllers was, quote, the most consequential foreign policy decision of his lifetime?
Well, I mean, I would say that that Scott Walker and Tom Cotton are not the first presidential candidates or, you know, senators to not necessarily be that well-versed in American foreign policy. I think that the difference is perhaps that they have more influence in their party than they've ever had before, or certainly than one would think appropriate. There are no sort of foreign policy graybeards in the Republican Party these days. You know, you look, for example, you know, who Jeb Bush was being advised by was people who had supported and implemented and advocated for the Iraq War. You know, in the case of Walker, he's being advised by people like Mark Thiessen, who's probably best known for being a cheerleader for waterboarding. So I think that's part of the issue, is you don't have the same kind of quality of people in the party. But I think also, you know, this kind of, it's not the first time that you see people who just have a lot of experience running for president. I think what's kind of upsetting about it a little bit is, I think, you know, the advice that they're getting is not the kind of advice that you want them to be getting. People like Walker, particularly, seem to be talking to folks who just kind of tell them what they want to hear or tell them things that sort of play on very sort of basic Republican ideas about foreign policy, that leadership is what matters. And, you know, symbolic decision-making is more important than sort of understanding nuances. You know, Walker likes to fail the time. He doesn't listen to much of PhDs to know what's right or wrong. He just knows what's right or wrong. If only foreign policy was that easy. Unfortunately, it's not.
Well, he also says that facing 100,000 demonstrators is a badge of honor and shows he's a tough guy. What he doesn't point out is that's 100,000 of his own citizens who are angry.
Of his own citizens, yes.
I mean, it's
unarmed, by the way. Unarmed, I should say that.
Well, but did this all begin, this growing anti-intellectualism in the Republican leadership ranks, did it begin with John McCain's choice of Sarah Palin as a presidential running mate?
Oh, I mean, I think it was back much further than that. I think you can go back to the, you know, to somebody like, you know, like Spiro Agnew being the VP pick in 1968 for Richard Nixon. I mean, this kind of anti-intellectualism, anti-elitism, it's sort of baked into the Republican Party. I think the difference is that a lot of people who sort of use that kind of rhetoric, you know, Nixon and Reagan and so forth, even George W. Bush sort of understood that it was for political purposes. But, you know, it does seem that now it's become sort of the politics that have become the policy. And someone like Cotton, who really is, you know, just completely out of his league on foreign policy, who just is all sort of bluster and not much in the way of smarts, is sort of running the show. I mean, if he could get 46 senators to sign this ridiculous letter, is extraordinary. And if there was no one in that, I mean, a few senators didn't sign it, Corker from Tennessee and a few others didn't sign it, but then nobody sort of said, this is a really bad idea, we should not be doing this. It's very striking. And I think, I would argue, I said, part of this is because people like Cotton, they represent a wing of the party that is very powerful and a lot of established Republicans are afraid of. You know, this guy's a Tea Partier, and I think people don't want to get on the wrong side of people like him, and they figure that the path of least resistance is to sign a letter like this. And you can see now the result of that decision. It's absolutely blown back in their face.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Cohen, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation, a columnist at the Boston Globe, where he writes a regular feature on politics and national security. Previously, he served in the U.S. Department of State as chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations, and his latest article at Foreign Policy is State of the Union Busters. You mentioned, Michael Cohen, the advice that some of these Republican presidential hopefuls and Tom Cotton are getting. Tom Cotton, of course, is a protege of Bill Kristol, one of the leading neoconservatives who helped sell the Iraq War. He's also financed by Paul Singer, the hedge fund fellow, as long with Sheldon Adelson. And Sheldon Adelson, of course, was featured heavily in the appearance of Prime Minister Netanyahu recently before the Congress, where, you know, it was hard to discern whether the Republicans are jumping to their feet because of Netanyahu or showing their loyalty to the money bags there. Sheldon Adelson, who Tom Friedman has written a piece about in Wednesday's New York Times, a column suggesting that Sheldon Adelson is essentially the Republican and the Israeli Prime Minister's kingmaker.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things going on here. I mean, I think part of it, clearly people like Adelson have a great deal of influence in the party. You saw this a few months ago when Chris Christie said something just sort of that Adelson didn't agree with about Israel, and Christie had to apologize publicly for saying it. But look, I mean, a larger issue here, and that is that, you know, in the Republican Party today, there is very strong support for Israel. And that support comes from, not from Jewish donors, but it comes from evangelicals, who in some ways, I would argue, are more supportive of Israel than American Jews are. And in a sense, you know, there's no political benefit, no political incentive for any Republican to get on the wrong side of that community when it comes to Israel. So when it comes to issues like Iran in particular, you know, their incentive structure says the more hardline hawkish they are, the better it is for them. And so I think that's what you're seeing going on, is what you saw with the speech in the House, and you're seeing with this letter. It's that, you know, the Republican Party has become sort of just almost maniacally pro-Israel, to a point where it's ever question what Israel does. What'll be interesting to see is there's an election in a couple of days in Israel, and the left, center-left, is slightly ahead. Now, if they are successful, the impact on the relationship between the right in the U.S. And Israel could be quite dramatic, actually. And you could see a real shift. In fact, you could see a real shift for both parties, with Democrats who can't stand Netanyahu all of a sudden we'll be embracing potentially a new Israeli prime minister. So I think, you know, that also, I think, speaks to how partisan and how political this relationship has become. in the sense that you have the Likud is now allied with the Republican Party, the Labor Party and the center left allied with the Democrats, and that's kind of where the politics of this are right now, and the relationship has a lot to do with who's in power in Israel.
But Michael Cohen, the fact that the so-called Christian Zionists, the evangelical wing of the Republican Party, support Israel, is in itself not only an example of anti-intellectualism, it's an example of a kind of theological pornography. It's insane, this idea that the end of times, that is, they love Israel because it facilitates the end of times.
And, yeah, that's right.
And the country is destroyed in the lake of fire along with the rest of us.
I guess if you're a politician, then you pour it in the storm. And from the perspective of the right in Israel, you know, it may be cynical, but certainly being allied with the far right in the U.S. has been somewhat beneficial to them. At least they can rely on the support of one political party. I mean, the downside, of course, is that that political party isn't very popular right now and is unlikely to win the presidential election anytime soon. So in a sense, you know, and Netanyahu did this in 2012, he put all of his chips on Romney, and he lost. And if that's affected the relationship very, very badly, you know, it may continue to get worse if he does win next week and as a Democrat in the White House, even after 2016. You know, it's going to be a tough relationship between the two sides because it's become so political and so partisan.
So what did you think of John Kerry's, you know, clearly outraged and frustrated response to this letter by Tom Cotton and the 47 Republicans, which Kerry hammered them, saying it was completely irresponsible?
I get pretty cynical about American politics. It's hard not to get cynical when you cover it closely. But to my mind, I was floored by this. It is such a violation of, you know, sort of basic norms in American politics that it really does sort of stun you a little bit. This was an effort by Republicans to basically go behind the back of the administration, to go directly to the Iranians and encourage them not to make a deal with the U.S. as being negotiated by the president. And, you know, with the result being that either A, Iran gets a bomb that much sooner, or B, there's a war between the U.S. and Iran. It is incredibly irresponsible. And it goes, you know, I think far beyond anything that we've seen in recent memory as far as a political party to do this. And again, what is shocking to me is it wasn't just one person doing it. It wasn't just Tom Cotton writing a letter to the mullahs in Tehran. It was 47 Republican senators signing the letter. That is shocking. And I think, you know, really does speak. You know, there's a myth in this country that foreign policy, you know, ends at the water's edge, or that we were bipartisan in foreign policy. It's not really true. But still, there are some lines you don't cross, and this one crossed the line. And coming on the heels, by the way, of Boehner's invitation to Netanyahu, which also crossed the line, we're just seeing incredible politicization of foreign policy, I think, to a very, you know, damaging and dangerous degree.
Well, in Kerry's testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where he made it clear that he felt that this letter was shocking, unprecedented. And Debbie Stabenow, Senator, she was equally angry and said, you know, I oppose Saddam Hussein, but I didn't write a letter to him, you know.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, it would be as if the U.S. Democrats went to Iraq before the Iraq War and said, listen, don't allow inspectors into the country when the Bush administration tried to push them in the fall of 2002. It's just don't give in to U.S. demands. It's really negotiating in a sense with the enemy. It's extremely provocative, and I think it just, again, like, it crosses a line that, you know, just usually people know better than not to cross.
Well, Michael Cohen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Cohen, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation and a columnist at the Boston Globe, where he writes a regular feature on politics and national security. Previously served in the U.S. State Department as a chief speechwriter for the UN, for the U.S. representative to the United Nations. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, State of the Union Buster. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back speaking with Andrew Coben about his new book, Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andrew Coburn, the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and the author of many articles and books on national security, including the New York Times Editor's Choice, Rumsfeld, and The Threat, which destroyed the myth of Soviet military superiority underpinning the Cold War. His latest book just out is Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Coburn.
Hi, Ian. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you, and this is a very timely book, and particularly, I think, in many ways, investigating the nature of the Counterterrorism Center. Just last Friday, the director of the CIA, John Brennan, addressed the CIA employees about his ideas and plans to revamp the agency to create more of these so-called fusion centers like the CTC, which have an incredibly disastrous record. So I guess the march of folly continues.
Well, that's right. I mean, here is, as you say, completely disastrous story of the CTC, which was, you know, from the word go, it's been, you know, was set up originally by William Casey for his own fell political reasons, basically because he wanted to get rid of sort of independent, objective intelligence analysis, and now Brennan wants to make the whole CIA like that.
And one of the extraordinary stories in your new book, Andrew Coburn, Kill Chain, is the story of Mike, this CTC director who, you know, you couldn't make this stuff up. Here in Hollywood, I don't think they could come up with a character like this, this strange fellow who not only became a Muslim convert, but a very devout Shiite, secretive. They haven't been able to fire this strange monk-like figure. And even the people that work with him think he's scary as hell. So tell us about Mike.
Well, Mike, yes, he came up. I mean, he's already a product of the CTC. I mean, each director of the CTC, I should say, of the Counterterrorism Center, has been, well, it was, as one of their colleague or former colleagues said to me, he said, I used to know them. I used to work with them. They all turned into maniacs. And Mike, in a kind of sort of timid way, I couldn't say his full name because he's theoretically undercover, although no one else in that job has been undercover. But he lives for the job. As you mentioned, he doesn't. He's reclusive. He hardly ever leaves his office. He sleeps in his office. He has a sort of rollout bed that he pulls out. The only time most people see him in daylight in the open air is when he goes out for a smoke in the courtyard, so I'm told. And he is, bizarrely, a Shiite Muslim because earlier in his career he married a Shiite lady who wasn't a hard over, you know, religious type, but Mike converted and took it all very, very seriously. And now he's the devout one. He prays regularly. Which is all fine. In a way, it might be nice idea to have a Muslim in a high position at the CIA. But the thing is, every previous director of the Counterterrorism Center sort of was gone within a year or so. They didn't. There was a pretty quick turnover. He's been there since 2006. And as you mentioned, he's become so powerful they can't get rid of him. He has his allies. He's built his alliances in the White House and on Capitol Hill. So although various directors have tried to ease him out, it doesn't work. So we've got this very, you know, as you said, someone who had worked with him and knew him quite well described him and said he's a scary guy. This rather frightening figure who is the controller of the drones. He's the drone master. I mean, he decides who to kill, basically. This reclusive figure with his prayer mat in the CIA.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Coburn, the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and the author of many articles and books on national security, including the New York Times Editor's Choice, Rumsfeld, and The Threat, which destroyed the myth of Soviet military superiority underpinning the Cold War. His latest book just out is Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. So do you think that one of the reasons why Mike is so insulated and has such political protection at the very top is to do with this propensity that we have, that we feel that there's always a technical fix for our military and diplomatic problems? Throughout the Cold War, there were ludicrous examples of trying to get around the issue of nuclear war with the Soviet Union, and the fact that we're in this paradox where the more nuclear weapons each side built, the less secure we became, yet we kept pouring more and more money into it. And eventually they came up with this magic bullet known as Star Wars that was a technical fix to an essentially arms control and diplomatic problem. Does this also apply to the drone program in the sense that...
Well, in a way, yes. It comes out, as you say, it comes out the same thing, this belief in magic weapons, you know, that we don't have to really deal with things politically and strategically in sort of proper sense, that there's a technical fix, there's a magic weapon that'll solve it. You know, so as you've mentioned, in the sort of mad old days of the Cold War, they were building ever more missiles that were meant to be ever more precisely accurate. They could sort of, the idea of dropping a nuclear weapon in one particular corner of the Kremlin or whatever. Now we have the whole cult of drones and of assassination. The idea being that there's somehow that we can know the enemy well enough and know exactly so well what we're dealing with, that we can identify the critical nodes, as they call them, and the important piece of machinery, which in the old days used to be like a thing, like a bridge or a power station or something like that. And they used to proceed on that basis. We saw that in the 1991 Gulf War, very perfectly expressed. Now it's people, you know. Now we, you know, how many, you know, we, the number three, the fun, and they get them all. You know, the way we've been treating Al Qaeda, it's like it's IBM or something. You know, we have identified the chief operating officer, and we, you know, we have hit him in his, you know, in his lair in the northwest frontier, and then, you know, a week later, we have to kill another one because it, as I explain in the book. You know, with what the record shows, and I got a hold of some very interesting records carried out by, very interesting studies carried out by military intelligence. It doesn't do you any good. I mean, you kill the top guy. There's a new top guy a day later, and he's likely to be more motivated and, you know, probably more efficient and so more effective than the guy you just got rid of, which is what actually has happened with, you know, ISIS and the Islamic State.
But in terms of the comparison, say, with Star Wars during the Cold War as a technical fix that doesn't work, and they're still, by the way, spending money on this thing that doesn't work.
More than ever, yeah.
So does that from your book, Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins, Andrew Coburn, it's pretty clear that all of these whiz-bang drones that we're spending money on, them, most of them are flying pieces of junk.
Well, I mean, they can fly because they're actually pretty simple machines, really, but it's essentially, essentially junk because they're overhyped. We're given the impression, and people on both sides of the argument, even the people who think it's a moral outrage we should be using these things, they all take as granted the idea that these are sort of technically so wonderful, and they can, you know, they can read a newspaper from, you know, miles high in the sky and unerringly pick out people, but which is actually not true. You know, I discovered that the infrared sensors on the Predator have a visual acuity of 20/200, which by an interesting coincidence is the legal definition of blindness for drivers in this country in most states. So we're sending these things which are transmitting back, you know, uncountable petabytes of information, which is, you know, blurry vision. So we're making these life and death decisions on a very blurry picture, both literally and figuratively, of what, you know, what we're actually fighting. So No wonder we're in a jam.
And they call this surveillance system aboard the Reaper Gorgon Stare. And as you point out in your book, Andrew Coburn, Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins, that Gorgon Stare's imagery is not as good as Google Earth's.
Well, I would say not as good. I mean, it's about the same, which for, you know, all the billions of dollars being poured into it, it should be a bit better. It's because Google Earth is taken from space. Yeah, I got hold of a test report from the Air Force. They did the test they did on this thing, Gorgon Stare, and actually rather wickedly in their test report they produce a picture taken by Gorgon Stare of an air base. I think it was Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, and then the same scene taken by Google Earth, and they're exactly the same. And you think, wow, that's what we spent umpteen billion dollars on, you know. And that's the least of it. Actually, most of the time, it doesn't work at all. You don't get any pictures because it breaks down all the time. And I mean, like, it takes too long. It would take us all afternoon to do all day to discuss it, all the things that are wrong with it. And yet, you know, any time you sort of tune in to the head of intelligence and surveillance of the U.S. Air Force, he'll tell you what a wonderful machine this is and how it's making a real difference in Afghanistan or wherever we happen to be fighting. And that is a total piece of junk. I mean, it's absolute junk and should never have been built or bought. But through to relationships, let's call them that, between the contractor and relevant components of the Air Force, it got built.
And that's the case, of course, with Global Hawk. Northrop, essentially through its lobbying, have kept this program going, even though within the Pentagon, as you point out in your new book, Andrew, it's described as a piece of junk.
Well, right. Yeah, there was actually... I was thinking Predator was a piece of junk. No, the Global Hawk, I mean, I was having breakfast in the with a very senior acquisition guy who buys weapons, official from the Pentagon, and we were talking about drones, and he suddenly said, Global Hawk, he said, Northrop Corporation took billions and billions of dollars off for that thing, and it's a piece of junk. And it's, you know, because, I mean, bits fall off it when it flies, because the glue is made of plastic, and the glue doesn't work so good sometimes. It can't fly when the weather's anything but calm, so it's, you know, some of them are based in the northern Pacific because they have trying to monitor North Korea. And for weeks, sometimes months almost on end, they have to stay on the ground because the weather's a bit tricky. It costs $300 million a piece. You know, it's a flying, sometimes flying, and more often sitting disaster.
But there was also the case of that other drone that looks a bit like the Batwing B-2 bomber that was lost over Iran and then ended up on display by the Iranians. There's never been an explanation for how that plane was intercepted and taken over, which is the assumption that many have. My understanding is that some of the equipment aboard that drone was the most advanced equipment that the U.S. Air Force has, particularly the radar that it has. Because, you know, radar, when you turn on your radar, it's like turning on a flashlight in a dark room. It identifies you as opposed to what you're supposed to be looking at. And they have apparently a radar now that you can, when you turn it on, nobody can see it. But that's now compromised. So did you learn anything about the fate of that drone?
Well, yes. You know, the thing about any drone, really, the way it sort of gets anywhere, the way it navigates or is navigated, is thanks to GPS, like you have in your phone or your car or wherever. And the GPS signal has to be, because it's coming from a small satellite, comparatively speaking, way out in space, you know, it's quite weak. The power of the signal is quite weak. It's like a car headlight miles away. I mean, the strength of that. So all you have to do is to have a kind of slightly stronger signal that mimics the GPS signal. And that's what the Iranians did. They fed a fake signal, sort of telling the drone that it was... Well, first of all, they cut off the drone's communications with its controller back at the base. Then they started to feed in basically fake GPS signals into the drone so that it thought it was flying back to Kandahar in Pakistan. But in fact, thanks to these fake signals, it was being guided into land in Iran, which it duly did. And that was fantastically it was a brilliant job by the Iranians that they were able to do that. In theory, at least, it's, you know, the concept is pretty easy to understand. In fact, there's a professor at University of Texas who keeps demonstrating this. He doesn't get the attention he deserves, but he keeps taking over drones and other GPS-guided things and, you know, sending them wherever he wants. So, it's an interesting aspect of our whole dependence on drone technology is that it's all dependent on GPS. I mean, they're making frantic efforts to produce anti-jamming devices to, you know, to make them more secure, but basically that can always be broken through, and so, you know, we're depending more and more on these things can easily be captured, as the Iranian one was.
But surely this would mean then that if a foreign enemy could capture a drone, an American drone, they could then fire the Hellfire missiles at, say, a wedding party. Not that that doesn't already happen, but couldn't this be used against the U.S. and turned into an incident that could blow up and enrage the world?
Sure, it could. I mean, we know already that them guys, so far as I know, they haven't got to, you know, that point. And we're quite good at blowing up wedding parties all on our own. But there have been cases where we know that people, you know, insurgent militias on the other side have, like, been using our drones to get, you know, surveillance pictures. They've just been tapping into the feed. So we've been obligingly supplying the other side with intelligence. But yeah, I mean, that's not far-fetched. I mean, as that's the point. These are essentially very vulnerable things which can either be shot down or taken over very easily.
So you were saying earlier, Andrew Coben, that critics of drones tend to exaggerate their effectiveness. And one of the things that I find difficult to understand, well, not so much difficult to understand, but I recognize the enormous passion people feel. This is an issue that really gets people very, very upset, not just the victims and the collateral damage at the wrong end of these things. But I'm talking about anti-war activists here in the United States, et cetera. And I've never understood, I don't quite understand the moral argument here in a sense that, is it morally superior to stick a bayonet in someone's guts and watch them die?
Well, I think people recoil from the whole, and you know, I agree with this, the whole remote control aspect. You know, at least, you know, if you're sticking a bayonet in someone's guts, at least you're there. You know, you may be running a risk yourself, and at least you've sort of engaged in it. Whereas, you know, the whole it's very creepy, this notion of someone sitting in Nevada. I mean, I describe in the first chapter of my book, I have a full account of an actual drone strike, including what the drone crew sitting in Nevada are saying to each other, which is actually pretty chilling. They really seem to be, well, they are looking forward to killing a few people, which they duly do. I think that's it. It's the sort of takes the humanity out of it. I quickly refer to, you know, I talk earlier in the book about an earlier effort at a remote control war, which was during the Vietnam War, when the U.S. wired the Ho Chi Minh Trail, thousands of square miles of jungle, with sensors, the idea being that when they sensed North Vietnamese supply columns coming through, they would send single signals back to a giant computer, which would then dispatch bombers to attack. And this became public thanks to the Pentagon Papers. And that aroused a furore. And there was actually I quote in the book, it was a group that had an anti-war meeting with the GI, you know, veterans, the Winter Soldier movement, were complaining, talking about this. And I just read you one sentence. I said, at a public meeting in Boston of the anti-war Winter Soldier movement, an embittered veteran, Eric Herter, testified eloquently and presently about, quote, the new forms of war that are to replace the unpopular struggle of infantry and patrol against guerrilla bands. This new war will not produce me lies. It will be war not of men at arms, but of computers and weapon systems against whole populations. Even the tortured bond of humanity between enemies at war will be eliminated. So I think that's what, you know, they were talking about. There's like, you know, actual, you know, atrocities that take place in war, which, you know, are horrible anyway, but at least they're between people. I think people, going back to your question, Ian, I think it's, you know, that what people are repelled by is this, an idea, this the impersonality, the cold-blooded impersonality of it all.
So in terms of desk jockeys with the toggle switch, pressing the button, killing people thousands of miles away in Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria or wherever, my understanding is that there's been some cases of PTSD amongst them. And is that because they also get to see the collateral damage? Because presumably the drone sticks around for damage assessment.
Well, yeah, they do. They spend a lot of time doing that. And there's a lot of talk of that, and we've heard a lot of talk of, you know, drone pilots getting PTSD. I have to say I'm skeptical. For what it's worth, the chief medical officer of the sort of drone part of the Air Force, the ISR division, he has said, asked about this, he said, actually, we've had one case, maybe, of PTSD in a sensor operator, otherwise. Now, maybe, you know, that's not an impartial source necessarily, but I've personally never met a drone pilot who complained. I know lots of veterans who, you know, talk about PTSD that they have and their problems with it and how they got it, and it's for a whole complex series of reasons. It's not just seeing a terrible thing happen. It's about the sort of pressure they were under and the fact they've been lied to by superiors. There's a whole bunch of things that seem to go into producing PTSD. I never found a drone operator who seemed to suffer from any of that, and I never actually, directly heard of one. As you see in the first chapter of my book with this, you know, actual drone strike, I mean, I've had a drone strike, those guys aren't suffering from PTSD, nothing close. They really, really enjoy their job. I mean, there are drone pilots who've come out, or very few, actually, who say they feel terrible at what they did, and they feel guilty, and they, you know, they worry about it. But that's a very limited number. You know, a few years ago, they said, well, we're in combat, too, and we should get medals. So the Defense Department, Pentagon came up with, I think it was called the Air Warfare Medal, which should be given for gallant service to drone pilots, you know, who are sitting in basically in an office in Nevada fighting the war. And there was such a scream of outrage from people who had actually been in real combat that the thing had to be withdrawn.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let's talk a little about Rex Ravalla, the former fighter pilot who exposed the incredible exaggeration of the effectiveness of the drone program.
Well, he's a very interesting guy indeed. Rex was a combat fighter pilot in Vietnam, flew hundreds of missions. And I tell a little story early in the book about how he became rather disenchanted with the, you know, the miracles of wonder weapons that we've been talking about, rather vivid experience he had. But then he, you know, he's a statistician, and he, in the 1990s, he was working for the Defense Department in a branch, basically an in-house think tank, that was tasked to take a look at the drug war. And you have to remember, the Defense Department doesn't have a big bureaucratic stake in the drug war. I mean, they have engaged to a certain amount, but not like the DEA or maybe even particularly the DEA and the Customs. So he was allowed to be fairly objective, and he found, which I describe it in detail in the book, he was able to calculate, and it's absolutely irrefutable, that the policy of high-value targeting against cartel leaders, which is what we're the same thing as we're doing against, you know, terrorist or, you know, ISIS leaders, that same strategy of going after the top guy, every time it succeeded, which it did, it was quite successful, but it had the inevitable effect of increasing the flow of drugs into this country, which was kind of counterintuitive, but if you read the book, you'll see why. Anyone who reads the book will see why. Then later in Iraq, he looked again at the how well this policy of assassination was going. You know, the whole strategy in Iraq was to find the insurgent leaders in every area and kill or maybe sometimes capture them. And so he took a look at that, and because he was in a secret intelligence cell, he had access to pretty much any information he wanted. So he was able to look at all the times they'd killed someone like that and what happened then, and he found that, again, the inevitable, you know, and every time result was the level of violence and mayhem and attacks on Americans and American casualties went up. Because when you kill the leader, he's immediately replaced, and he then he has to prove himself, and he has to, you know, rally the troops, and maybe the former leader was getting a bit lazy and wasn't working as hard and planting bombs and so forth, and the new guy is determined to prove himself, and that's what happened. And I found exactly the same thing happened in Afghanistan. In fact, in the book, I have quotes from Taliban. A Taliban leader has succeeded, another Taliban leader who's killed, and another who in turn has succeeded another one. And, you know, they are more vehement than their predecessors. And the ultimate example is what we're facing now with ISIS. Mr. Baghdadi succeeded a previous leader who was pretty formidable, but not as much as the leader of ISIS, the present leader of ISIS, who was killed, who had in turn succeeded Mr. Zarqawi, who was our big enemy back then, and we thought if we killed him, our problems would be over, and we did kill him. So we got Masri, who was worse, and then we killed him, and now we have Baghdadi, who's the worst of the lot. So it's a very simple, and it doesn't, you know, Ravallo brought this out with, you know, very careful statistical analysis. I mean, these aren't just assumptions. He actually shows with the actual numbers and percentages and, you know, it's very cut and dried. And he tried to tell the high command that, look, guys, what you're doing isn't working. And they said, oh, well, it's too difficult to change things. And, you know, basically there was just too much of a bureaucracy behind assassination because...
Right. It's the what they call the iron rice bowl in Mao's China.
good one. Yeah.
Well, Andrew Coben, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Hey, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Coben, the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and the author of many articles and books on national security, including the New York Times editor's choice, Rumsfeld, and The Threat, which destroyed the myth of Soviet military superiority underpinning the Cold War. His latest book just out is Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into why the White House folded on a ban of cop-killing bullets. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now are Daniel Webster, Professor of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he serves as Director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research, Deputy Director of Research for the Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence, and Director of the PhD Program in Health and Public Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Webster.
Thanks for having me.
And the White House has caved in, apparently under pressure from the NRA, to go ahead with a ban of what's essentially cop killer ammunition that can pierce police protective vests. Yeah, I take it that there is already an existing federal law called the Federal Enforcement Officers Protection Act that banned these kind of bullets, but an exemption was made for these particular bullets that the ATF tried to ban for so-called sporting purposes, such as target shooting. So let's begin with that. How did that exemption get in? And now the ATF tried to get rid of that exemption and all hell broke loose on Capitol Hill.
Well, I think it's sort of another example of the gun lobby flexing its muscles and thinking basically their only concern seems to be satisfying the gun enthusiast and the industry. And so it's hard for me to reconcile some sort of rational argument for why it's essential for that type of ammunition to be available to citizens. The rifles that they like, including the AR-15, can use other types of ammunition that don't penetrate the protective vest that law enforcement officers wear.
So the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Bob Goodlatte of Virginia, said on Tuesday that he applauded the reversal by the ATF, saying he was pleased that the Obama administration had abandoned this attack on the Second Amendment. How could banning armor-piercing bullets that would penetrate the protective vests of police officers be an assault on the Second Amendment?
Well, of course it wouldn't. It has nothing to do with the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment, based upon recent Supreme Court decisions, basically says that law-abiding citizens have a right to keep a gun in their home for their self-defense. The policy being put forward to ban these armor-piercing bullets certainly would not deprive anyone of their ability to keep a gun in their home for self-defense.
Well, apparently the reason why the ATF decided to remove this exemption on these bullets was because there are now small versions of the AR-15 that are essentially pistol size, mm-hmm. That fire these high-caliber, high-velocity bullets that can pierce bulletproof vests. So I take it that was the reason why. I mean, first of all, they got the exemption for so-called sporting purposes. I don't know what the difference is shooting a regular AR-15 bullet at a target and then shooting these armor-piercing bullets. Is there any difference? I mean, what is the, in terms of sporting purposes and target shooting? I mean, do you need an armor-piercing bullet to shoot a deer?
No, of course you don't. You don't need an armor-piercing bullet. You don't need an assault rifle. People have been doing that for many years before the gun industry decided that it could profit greatly by selling both firearms and ammunition that really were made for military purposes.
But apparently the reason that this the ATF folded on this and that the White House folded is because there was a blizzard of mail from 80,000 people organized by the NRA, and also there were objections from 291 members of Congress in both the House and Senate. So, again, you get back to the idea that somehow or other, in spite of the fact that the police themselves have been lobbying heavily to have these cop-killing bullets banned, it can't be done. Every time there's a massacre, there's an outrage from the public, but yet efforts to curb the proliferation of high-caliber weapons with big magazines that seem to be able to easily end up in the hands of criminals and mentally ill people, nothing gets done. As a gun control advocate, what keeps you going? Because it seems like the NRA have got the game sewn up.
Well, first of all, I don't necessarily categorize myself as a gun control advocate. I'm a researcher. I do advocate based upon research evidence. But really, to me, this is yet another example in which the NRA has sort of masterfully basically changed the argument. When you put forward a very common sense policy, whether it's universal background checks or it's banning ammunition that will penetrate law enforcement officers' protective armor, the NRA changes the subject and basically says they are trying to take your guns from you. And that is what causes so many people to respond in the way they did to this proposal by the ATF. And, you know, I just I just sort of marvel at how they're able to get away with changing the argument or changing the subject. If somehow there could be more discipline in keeping focus on what the policy is and does and what it doesn't do, and try to get us away from these cultural debates that will probably never end. You know, there's always going to be a group that really loves their guns and another group that really does not. I don't think we're going to see a difference there. But the important thing is that for the vast majority of policies relevant to public safety as it relates to firearms, there's really widespread agreement. We want to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people. We don't need armor-piercing bullets. And that just is a widely held view for gun owners, Republicans, Democrats, sort of across the board. So if we could get away from what the NRA wants the discussion to be, which is we love our guns and this is all about the Second Amendment, they win. But if you can somehow have the, the discipline or focus to keep the focus on what does this policy do and what does it not do, and perhaps fewer members of Congress would feel so compelled that they have to try to squash something like this that is so common sense.
And again, I'm speaking with Daniel Webster, who's a professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he serves as director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research, deputy director of research for the Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence, and director of the PhD program in health and public policy. So, Daniel, did you see the recent Frontline special on PBS on the NRA?
I only saw a little bit of it. I did not see the whole thing.
Well, you probably saved yourself a depressing experience, because it really made the point that the NRA is incredibly efficient and effective as a lobby because it's sort of its rapid response, where it can get literally, you know, in minutes, it can get hundreds of thousands of letters, emails, etc., blitzing the Congress and congresspeople. And this looks like what happened here, right? 80,000 complaints to the ATF?
Yes. But, you know, I think it's easy to also overstate the power of the NRA. The NRA has as much power as we allow it to have. And there are plenty of politicians who have made hard decisions in the name of public safety that have made the NRA unhappy and gone on to be reelected. So I think it's easy to sort of give them more power than really what is reality, that politicians should feel able to really make the right decisions for public safety. They can do so knowing that the vast majority of gun owners actually agree with them. That's what all of our polling has said on about any policy that we look at that is designed to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people and generally are not constructed to disarm anyone. And this policy that we're talking about today of proposing to outlaw ammunition that can penetrate law enforcement body armor falls right into that category of it's a common sense public safety measure that doesn't disarm anyone. And generally, we've found in our polls that those kind of measures get very widespread support from gun owners.
So why not form an alternative to the NRA of gun owners who are sensible? Because the NRA is essentially the lobby for the gun manufacturers and the ammunition manufacturers. They're the people who give them money. They do get money from their members, but their principal function is as a lobby for the gun manufacturers and ammunition manufacturers, and they just want to, obviously just want to sell their product, and they don't care about the consequences.
Right. So I think that's an excellent question. Why not form such a group? I hope such a group does form. I think that this group has mostly been on the sidelines because many of the groups who have over over many years advocated for stronger gun laws, in some cases can be portrayed as sort of anti-gun, and to that means to a gun owner, anti-gun owner. And I don't think that that's principally their true positions, but I think they've been easily pigeonholed or portrayed in that way. So I think that perhaps there's some unique role and potential new organization for gun owners that, you know, make strong cases to say we're responsible individuals. We value our freedoms to be able to purchase and possess guns, but we also are responsible and believe that we can make our communities safer with some common sense measures.
So it's time to recruit Tom Selleck, who's a spokesperson for the NRA.
I don't know if it'll be Tom Selleck, but certainly there are gun owners, because I've spoken to them on numerous occasions, and who do feel deeply about this topic, do feel that we could make some very positive change. But unfortunately, they haven't been heard.
Well, but, you know, there are a lot of police officers and law enforcement officers in this country, and they got to take this stuff very personally, that they can't even be protected against armor-piercing bullets that will penetrate their vests, and that are now being used in handguns.
Yes, I suspect that many law enforcement officers will feel that this policy is very irresponsible and really does not take into consideration the risks posed to law enforcement officers every day they go to their jobs.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Daniel Webster.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Webster, who's a professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he serves as director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research, deputy director of research for the Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence, and director of the PhD program in health and public policy. And again, I'd like to invite you to the UCLA Hammer Forum I'm moderating on Thursday, March the 19th at 7:30 p.m., Terror in the Name of Islam, with former MI6 officer Richard Barrett and former jihadi Mubin Sheikh. They'll provide insight into why young Muslims in the diaspora joined jihadist movements, and Mubin Sheikh joined al-Qaeda after 9/11. He did his religious studies in Syria, but then relinquished violent interpretations of Islam and volunteered with the Canadian Security Intelligence Service to fight terrorism. Again, Thursday, March the 19th at 7:30 p.m., Terror in the Name of Islam. Join me, free and open to the public, at the UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.